tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. Moving on to the next section, right mindfulness and right concentration. The canon contains a number of similes showing that the state of awareness appropriate for the restraining role of right mindfulness can be either narrowly focused or broadly relaxed, as the need may be. This is important to note because some modern writers, in an effort to draw a radical distinction between mindfulness and concentration, maintain that mindfulness is broad and receptive, whereas concentration is narrow and exclusive. Actually, this distinction misrepresents the canon in two important ways. The first is that it misrepresents the relative breadth of the two qualities. As we learn from the similes of the monkey and the quail, the proper establishing of mindfulness requires that you set limits on the range of your mindful awareness. Other discourses show that when defilements are strong, those limits have to be extremely narrow so that you can stay focused on the problem at hand and avoid the very real dangers of distraction. It's a quote from Anguttara 10, Sutta number 51. If on examination a monk knows, I usually remain covetous with thoughts of ill will, overcome by sloth and drowsiness, restless, uncertain, angry, with soiled thoughts, with my body aroused, lazy or unconcentrated, then he should put forth intense desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness for the abandoning of those very same evil, unskillful qualities. Just as when a person whose turban or head was on fire would put forth intense desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness to put out the fire on his turban or head, in the same way the monk should put forth intense desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness for the abandoning of those very same evil, unskillful qualities. Mindfulness in this case reminds the monk that the need to abandon unskillful mental qualities takes precedence above all else, and that he shouldn't allow himself to be distracted by other issues. This is a time to focus attention exclusively on this task. Here is another simile making the same point. And this is from Samyutta 47, Sutta number 20. Suppose, monks, that a large crowd of people comes thronging together saying, "The beauty queen, the beauty queen." And suppose that the beauty queen is highly accomplished at singing and dancing, so that an even greater crowd comes thronging saying, "The beauty queen is singing, the beauty queen is dancing." Then a man comes along, desiring life and shrinking from death, desiring pleasure and abhorring pain. They say to him, "Now look here, mister, you must take this bowl filled to the brim with oil and carry it on your head in between the great crowd and the beauty queen. A man with a raised sword will follow right behind you, and wherever you spill even a drop of oil, right there will he cut off your head." Now what do you think, monks? Would that man, not paying attention to the bowl of oil, bring heedlessness outside? No, Lord. I've given you the simile to convey a meaning. The meaning is this: the bowl filled to the brim with oil stands for mindfulness immersed in the body. These two similes show that there are times when the dictates of mindfulness can require an intensely focused and narrow state of attention, blocking out all distractions. At other times, mindfulness can be broad and relaxed, especially when the mind is free from unskillful thinking. When the mind tires, even of skillful thinking, this broadened mindfulness prepares the mind to enter into the jhanas, the stages of right concentration. And this is illustrated from Sutta Majjhima 19. And as I remain thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, thinking imbued with renunciation, non-ill will, harmlessness arose in me. I discerned that thinking imbued with harmlessness has arisen in me, and that leads neither to my own affliction, nor to the affliction of others, nor to the affliction of both. It fosters discernment, promotes lack of vexation, and leads to Nibbana. If I were to think and ponder in line with that even for a night, even for a day, even for a day and night, I do not envision any danger that would come from it, except that thinking and pondering a long time would tire the body. When the body is tired, the mind is disturbed, and a disturbed mind is far from concentration. So I steady my mind right within, settled, unified, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind would not be disturbed. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been gathered into the village, a cow herd would look after his cows. While resting under the shade of a tree or out in the open, he simply keeps himself mindful of those cows. In the same way, I simply kept myself mindful of those mental qualities. Unflagging persistence was aroused in me, and unmuddled mindfulness established. My body was calm and unaroused, my mind concentrated and single. Quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful qualities, I entered and remained in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. With the stilling of directed thoughts and evaluations, I entered and remained in the second jhana, rapture and pleasure born of concentration, unification of awareness, free from directed thought and evaluation. Internal assurance. With the fading of rapture, I remained equanimous, mindful, and alert, and sensed pleasure with the body. I entered and remained in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, equanimous and mindful, he has a pleasant abiding. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, as with the earlier disappearance of joy and distress, I entered and remained in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain. So mindfulness is not always a broadly receptive state of mind. The relative breadth of its focus has to be elastic, dictated by the strength of restraint needed in the presence or absence of strong defilements. I thought what I'd do is read the whole sutta of the Majjhima 19. It's the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, two kinds of thought, and it's the Buddha himself talking about his practice while he was still before his enlightenment. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anatta Pindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus." "Venerable sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thought into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty." And so those are Michya Sankapa and Samma Sankapa in the Eightfold Path. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, A thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus. This thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered, this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered, this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me. And then goes on the same, it's repeated. A thought of cruelty arose in me. I understood thus. This thought of cruelty has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus, so on and so forth, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of cruelty arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of non-cruelty to cultivate the thought of cruelty, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of cruelty. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too, I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of non-ill will arose in me. And so on and so forth. A thought of non-cruelty arose in me. I understood thus. This thought of non-cruelty has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, so forth, upon thoughts of non-cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of cruelty to cultivate the thought of non-cruelty. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-cruelty. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops had been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that those states were there. Tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled, and my mind concentrated and unified. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, and then it goes through all the jhanas through to the I directly knew. Birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. This was my third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. Suppose, bhikkhus, that in a wooded range, there was a great low-lying marsh near where a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared, desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage, and he closed off the safe and good path to be traveled joyfully, and he opened up a false path, and he put out a decoy and set up a dummy, so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster, and loss. But another man came desiring their good, welfare, and protection, and he reopened the safe and good path that led to their happiness, and he closed off the false path, and he removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy, so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. Because I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning, this is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasures. The large herd of deer is a term for beings. The man desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. The false path is a term for the wrong eightfold path, that is, wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. The dummy is a term for ignorance. The man desiring their good, welfare, and protection is a term for the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. The safe and good path to be traveled joyfully is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So, bhikkhus, the safe and good path to be traveled joyfully has been reopened by me, the wrong path has been closed off, the decoy removed, the dummy destroyed. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you, bhikkhus. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. I think one of the most important senses is that whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. And that is important to be taking note of that. understanding that. So it's certainly a function of mindfulness. Any questions?
Yes.
I'm trying to remember where I heard this sort of progression. Like, so one thinks, so one does, so one does, so one becomes, that will be their abiding or something like that. I don't even know if it's a Buddhist, maybe, but upon a shot.
Could be in the... would it be in the honey ball? There's a, because there is a progression there in the honey ball, and I can't remember it exactly. The honey ball sutta. It's a good one to check up again anyway. Did the banya?
How's it different from ill will?
Cruelty is ill will is harboring, say, anger, aversion. Cruelty is thinking, how am I going to get back at this person? How am I going to plot their destruction and their ruin? It maps non ill will and non cruelty. Non ill will correlates with metta, loving kindness, and non cruelty maps with compassion.
I was just thinking about the other point. It was interesting to me in that one of with the cows. Once the danger from destroying the crops is gone, then it's like the mental states that he coincides those with of non ill will, non cruelty, simplicity, renunciation are can still be there. But you don't. It's not like you have to obliterate them to realize concentration, but that you just mindfully know that they're present.
They're present. It's not. I mean, how do you say? It's not critical, but it's not. There's a bit more space to work around it.
Yeah. You don't have to do anything with them. Yeah. When your opposites are there, you kind of have to take care of it.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah.
When he's talking about right concentration, is right concentration and jhana, are they one and the same? Or?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Well, that, of course, that's a raging controversy in many places, but but I would say so. Yes, the Buddha consistently defines right concentration as the jhanas, but it's also important to sort of see that not turning the jhanas into some attainment thing, but recognizing that it's actually something that it's where the mind wants to go when it's ready to put down the obstacles. And sort of like it's also one of the images is as it being a nourishment. This is how we really nourish the mind. Rather than something you achieve and then you become some special person because you got the jhana sort of thing. it's a different, it's held very differently. Maria.
If the mind is strained and tired, what might some antidotes be?
Well, I think that one of the interesting was sort of like, because he's equating the mind and the body. So that because the one is sort of okay, how can I put down that obsessive thinking or restless thinking, even if it's wholesome, even if it's wholesome, it still is tiring. So then, learning how to put that down. I think one of the ways that I certainly find helpful is again coming back to the body, and using the rhythm of the breath, using the mindfulness of the body to settle to consciously relax. Then the body becomes relaxed, the mind becomes relaxed as well.
I think in terms of being tired. It's a, if you're tired, your mind is strained.
Right.
I think the one thing that always hit me about that was it's like with excessive thinking and pondering, the body is tired.
Right.
And yeah. Then the mind.
Because the body's tired and strained.
Gets far from concentrated.
Yeah.
So it's just as you were saying, it's going back to the body to be with the body, to refresh the body.
Refresh the body.
And then the mindfulness.
Yeah. They work together. They actually live together. Okay. I'll reread that. What Ajahn Jeff says after he gave that quote from the Majjhima 19. So mindfulness is not always a broadly receptive state of mind. The relative breadth of its focus has to be elastic, dictated by the strength of restraint needed in the presence or absence of strong defilements. And it's ironic that mindfulness is often portrayed as broad in opposition to the supposed narrowness of concentration. For concentration is actually the mental state that the Buddha consistently describes as expansive. This is easily seen in the similes he uses to describe the four jhanas, all of which involve a full body awareness. And these are images from Majjhima 119, which is the Gayagata Sati Sutta, Mindfulness of the Body Sutta. The first jhana, the image is just as if a dexterous bathman or bathman's apprentice would pour bath powder into a brass basin and knead it together, sprinkling it again and again with water so that his ball of bath powder, saturated, moisture-laden, permeated within and without, would nevertheless not drip. In the same way, the monk permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And the image for the second jhana, just like a lake with spring water welling up from within, having no inflow from the west, from the east, west, north, or south, and with the skies supplying abundant showers time and again, so that the cool fount of water welling up from within the lake would permeate and pervade, suffuse and fill it with cool waters, there being no part of the lake unpervaded by the cool waters. In the same way, the monk permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of concentration. The third jhana. Just as in a lotus pond, some of the lotuses born and growing in the water stay immersed in the water and flourish without standing up out of the water, so that they are permeated and pervaded, suffused and filled with cool water from their roots to their tips. And nothing of those lotuses would be unpervaded with cool water. In the same way, the monk permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the pleasure divested of rapture. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded with pleasure divested of rapture. The fourth jhana, just as if a man were sitting covered from head to foot with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his body to which the white cloth did not extend, in the same way, the monk sits permeating the body with a pure, bright awareness. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by pure, bright awareness. So to the extent that there is a distinction in the way the discourses represent the relative breadth of mindfulness and concentration, concentration is the quality consistently portrayed as broad and expansive, whereas mindfulness has to shift the breadth of its focus, sometimes broad, sometimes narrow, in line with events. Any questions?
This is a bit technical, I suppose, but from the minor to the severe, someone who's experiencing physical pain, like from small back or leg aches to like chronic pain, can they never penetrate right concentration?
Oh, actually, it goes the other way. Mm-hmm. That oftentimes when one is experiencing, I mean, it can be an obstacle, when the mind is settled and well established in stability, then the pain actually drops away, and the mind gels, comes together, and the body. Perception of the body falls away in terms of the pain. It's not that one is unaware of the body, but that perception of pain drops away, and the mind stands up very bright and experiencing just pleasure. It's possible. And it's something that one, and also see, that's a thing. It's pain is there's a couple different ways. One is that pain generally, you know, we experience in different places in the body, but the rest of the body. It might not be experiencing the pain. We don't usually notice that. So then you shift your focus to a place where it's either neutral or actually, even though, you know, my back's really killing me, but I feel really comfortable right here. And so you can draw attention to that place of comfort and ease. So that's a way of. I mean, you also have to pay attention. I mean, there is a sense that you also have to pay attention to what pain is telling you, in the sense that you might have terrible posture, you should really be adjusting your posture, or you're doing it with too much, an excessive focus in some way or another, but once there's that general balancing, one can be choosing where one directs one's attention, and then also that sense of pain. Even one can acknowledge pain, and just see it as pain, because what's really painful about pain is the way we hate it, and whereas when one can take pain and use it as an object sometimes, and then one can enter into it and start just seeing the arising and ceasing of sensation, and the mind doesn't start labeling it as pain. And as something that one is averse to or fearful of.
Does jhana can arise while you're doing walking meditation?
Pardon?
Is it more accessible when you sit or walking?
It's more accessible when one sits, but it's not impossible in walking meditation. And actually, the Buddha actually says that's one of the benefits of walking meditation, is that the concentration that arises from walking meditation is very stable, because it requires a real non-distraction of one's attention.
In a way, to help support.
Like, oh, totally, totally, totally help support. It goes both ways.
Because I remember Ajahn Bumpo even mentioned something about he has very encountered that kind of jhana while he's walking, but he didn't go into detail about.
Who was that?
Rompovi?
Oh, yes.
So I never experienced that, so I thought, that's very interesting.
Well, there's probably lots you haven't experienced. You sort of just take what the different teachers say. Okay, it's held up as these are possibilities. Okay? Yeah.